Hello and welcome to 10 by 9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Doran, and this is the 10 by 9 podcast. So this is now podcast 301, and to mark that milestone, I've been taking another dive into the murky depths of the 10x9 archive, and it's been great. I've been listening to stories from our first recordings, and I've selected 3 from 2016, 2017 for this podcast, and I can remember each one from when it was first told.
The garlic bread arrived, and I noted immediately that Mr. A helped himself before offering me any.
He wore a mustache long after it was out of style and long before it would be in style again. He was hairy and sweated a lot. I thought he was the most beautiful man I'd ever seen.
Is that calf a boy or a girl, I asked. A boy, why? I handed him the tag. He had given the calf an earring before he clocked the number and smiled to humour me. 007.
So expect romantic dates that went nowhere, a first love that went nowhere, and a spot of bovine matchmaking that went somewhere unexpected. Remember, these are from our earliest recording efforts, so they might not be quite as crystal clear as you're used to. And just in case the young ones or the sensitive are listening, each story has the occasional F-bomb, but it's sparing and used really well. Okay then, let's get started and let's go back to September 2016 and to Belfast Black Box, our home venue. It was our annual comedy fundraiser, so here's funny girl Caroline Orr.
So often in my experience, something which may seem small to some people can be a deal breaker on a date. At least it has always been that way for me. Tonight I share with you some of my most disappointing dates and how I knew that they would not have sequels. Date number one, garlic bread. My friends had set me up with Mr. A. That used to happen a lot, and then it didn't anymore. They gave up. I had met Mr. A a few times, and he seemed nice enough. No strange traits, or as a friend of mine would say, no dysmorphic features. And I was impressed that he had actually gone to the trouble of getting my number and phoning me to invite me out. Old school. Nobody does that anymore. Not that it's out Facebook nonsense. I thought his effort should not be in vain, and so I said yes. The night of our date came, and I made a bit of an effort. You know, a wee bit of extra lipstick, a new pair of tights, a wee drop or two of Chanel. About five changes of outfit strewn across my bed, just like in an old movie I'd once seen with Meryl Streep and Robert De Niro. Some of you oldies will know it. My date arrived to pick me up in a really crap car. I've always been teased about attracting men who drive really crap cars, or worse still, ride bikes. I don't drive myself. I know nothing about cars and I'm even less interested in them, but even I knew this one was crap. It was a dilapidated brown Mini, before Minis were cool, with a hole in the floor. A pair of tights lay ominously on the dashboard. Apparently you never knew when your fan belt might go. I think that's what Mr. A said, but to be honest, I was too busy concentrating on wondering who had had to surrender the tights. I wasn't giving mine up. We went to an Italian restaurant, not a bad choice I thought, not too ostentatious, plenty of things I liked, but I knew I wasn't really that keen on him because I was starving and I've never been able to eat on a date with a man that I'm interested in, at least not for the first week. After that, I could eat any man under the table or arm wrestle him to the ground if he tried to eat my sticky toffee pudding. We ordered and this is where it began to go wrong. The waiter wanted to know, did we want garlic bread? Mr. A looked at me. Of course we did, I thought. One portion or two, said the waiter. How many pieces are in a portion, says Mr. A. 3, says the waiter. At this point I'm thinking, well, I could definitely eat that. But Mr. A said, oh, aye, one will be enough. Bad sign. I didn't want to seem greedy, so I said nothing. The garlic bread arrived, and I noted immediately that Mr. A helped himself before offering me any. Uh-uh. I wondered what would happen to the third piece. Would he offer it to me? Would he split it? This was an important moment, and I think you all know. Mr. A reached forward and wolfed it down in one go. Reader, I did not marry him. Date number two, chicken and chips. I should never really have agreed to go out with Mr. E. My sister had made it clear that she quite liked him, and I felt slightly treacherous to accept his invitation. I should have known no good would come from it. We were going out together, but in a church group. Now, for those of you who've never been on a church group outing, in those days it meant a crowd of young people in convoy, setting off from the church, driving round in circles, wasting petrol, and ending up eating chips in a greasy cafe or Bangor seafront. On this particular occasion, about 40 of us ended up playing volleyball at the Valley Leisure Centre. Romantic or what? It got worse. We finished the game and off the convoy headed for chips. We went up to the counter and ordered. Mr. E asked if I could pay, as he didn't want to break a tenner and he'd noticed that I had a £5 note in my purse. Classic. I'd mentioned the fact that I really fancied chicken and chips, but we had a problem. There was only one portion left. Mr. E immediately announced that he was having it. I naively thought, oh, it's not too bad, sure, I'll get a wee share of it, maybe. I thought wrong. We got into Mr. E's car to eat our supper, and his head literally never lifted from the paper. He didn't offer me any, nor did he speak, until he had demolished the lot. He then rolled the paper into a ball, tossed it out the window, burped loudly, and declared that grease fairly goes for your stomach. I had never wanted him more. Reader, I did not marry him either. Number three, coffee. This was the date that never actually happened, and probably just as well. I was walking along the Lisburn Road all of a summer's day when a very handsome foreign gentleman approached me and asked if he could walk with me. It threw me a little bit, but I thought, this is quite quaint. I guess he was probably new in town, maybe a bit lonely, and to be honest, he was very good looking. I reasoned that this sort of thing happened in the movies all the time, so why not in real life? I pictured us in one of those montage scenes, walking along an empty beach barefoot, at a market, juggling oranges. They always juggle oranges in those things, don't they? Well, sitting by a fire, glass of wine. Anyway, back to reality. It transpired that my suitor was from Turkey and that he'd been in Belfast for just a while. He asked if I would have coffee with him, and I explained I had to meet my sister after a quick dash to Tesco's, but maybe another time. He asked if he could come to Tesco's with me. Again, I was a little bit thrown, but it was certainly a first, and what the hell. When I told this story to a colleague later, she said, when I got to this point, now why did you not just tell him to fuck off? She was never one to mince her words, but why indeed? He followed me round the shelves, passing comment on what I bought. Lettuce in bag, waste of money. Two potatoes, this is all. No meat. I got to the till, and still he was there. I asked what had brought him here, and he said, woman. Of course it was. He asked for my number, but I was a wee bit unsure and wise enough to say, no, you give me yours. He wrote it down, then he said, you will not call. I know this because I know all Irish women. She is like a snake. He'd obviously had a few bad experiences. He asked where I lived, and I was a bit vague. Then he started to get angry and he said, look, I'm not trying to jump you and I'm not asking you to marry me. I just want to go for coffee. This was becoming more and more unappealing, but also faintly ridiculous, and people could hear him in the vegetable aisles. I laughed nervously. Then he got really mad. What do you laugh at? I assured him I wasn't laughing at him, but that I was a bit embarrassed and that I tend to laugh a lot. He was now waving his arms around. I too laugh when something is funny. But you are laughing for no reason, because you are empty head. I was actually quite speechless. It was probably, looking back on it, was probably a cultural misunderstanding, but coffee was definitely no longer on the cards. And I decided that meetings like this were best left in the movies. So, reader, I didn't marry him either, funny enough. I could tell you lots more similar stories, stories of moments when you just know. That crumb that's sticking to his beard. The driving gloves that my friend was put off by. Double denim. Don't go there, boys, don't go there. But sometimes it works the other way around. My sister had been out for dinner with a certain Croatian gentleman several times and she wasn't quite sure whether she wanted to go any further. Then he took her to his workplace so she could see what he did. He's a baker, and my sister, like myself, loves a good cake. She told me about it the next day, and I quote, "He took me to his bakery and he showed me his pecan pies. That's when I knew." Reader, that was 9 years ago, and they've been together since. And I'm still moving.
Thanks so much, Caroline. Great to hear that story again. And Caroline is still a regular at our live events and freely admits that initially she thought 10x9 would never catch on. Nor did I, Caroline. Nor did I. Even if we're revisiting the past, 10x9 still goes on and is always looking for new storytellers. If you're wondering what the process is for telling your story, it's simple. Check out the themes and dates on the website. Send your story through the submissions page, I'll give you feedback and help you make it the best it can be. Alternatively, you can email me directly at 10by9belfast@gmail.com. Okay, on to our next story, and it was May 2017 and the theme was changing. Now, 10by9 has always attracted more Americans to the podium than just about any other non-local nationality, which is great. It's a format they really take to, so what could be more appropriate than the soft southern accent of Brian Ammons?
Hi, y'all. I'm not from around here, and I'm a bit jet-lagged. I just got in today, but I'm really happy to be here. He was shorter than me, a bit overweight, green eyes, and reddish-brown hair that was already thinning at age 20. He wore a mustache long after it was out of style and long before it would be in style again. He was hairy and sweated a lot. I thought he was the most beautiful man I'd ever seen. My first love was Philip Hansberry, and it feels funny saying that out loud in public even now. Our love was such a secret. We worked together at Boy Scout camp in the U.S. South. Philip was a few years older than me and the program director, so he lived in this really cool cabin that had a loft and a bedroom and was connected to the program office. He had a little TV VCR combo, and sometimes I would go there to watch old movies late at night. We sat on a tiny sofa, a love seat, really. As weeks went on, when our legs brushed against one another, we wouldn't pull away. Eventually, we would lean into one another, welcoming the presence of the other's shoulder, hearts racing but not flinching. And then one night we fell asleep watching the movie. Our heads fell towards each other. As the credits rolled in a half-awake stupor, we turned towards each other and our lips met. Our first kiss, soft and subtle and too sleepy to have thought better of it. That is, until we were suddenly wide awake and fully aware of what had just happened. We both leapt from the sofa, and my feet did not touch the ground until I was standing in the doorway. He looked at the floor, I looked at the ceiling. We mumbled goodnight, and I left. We never spoke of it again. But as the summer went on, whenever we were alone, he would reach for my hand. Driving into town or walking through the woods, our hands seemed to know the truth that scared us too much to admit. We stayed in touch through the school year, but it wasn't until the next summer that we finally gave in. I got a promotion, and so along with our mutual friend Robert, moved into the lower bedroom of the central cabin. Philip fixed up the loft with a double bed and moved up there. Robert was a heavy sleeper. And by the end of the first week, I began waiting for his first snort and then sneaking up to climb in bed with Philip, staying there until daybreak and then sneaking back down to my bed before Robert woke. If he ever noticed, and surely he did, he never said a word. So perhaps, as the summer wore on, we got more and more bold, and maybe even a bit careless. One late afternoon, we'd been out hiking, and we realized it was much later than we thought. It was family night, which meant that Philip and I were supposed to be running the big campfire program at the arena. We darted back to the cabin to have a quick shower and get dressed in our Class A uniforms. There was only one shower in the cabin, and it was oddly located off the office part of the building rather than the living quarters. Robert was out, so we just jumped in the shower together. It's important here to note that in the late 80s and early 90s, some folks in Boy Scouts became rather fixated on purging the movement of gay and bi folk. Leading the charge in the council where I grew up was our chief executive scout. His name was Hal. And by that summer, he'd launched something akin to a witch hunt that had already publicly outed and ousted some of our most beloved leaders. It's also important to note that the shower curtain did not reach to the floor. It was what one might call T-length. So when Hal knocked on the door, telling Philip to hurry up because he needed to talk to him, we panicked. When we heard the door creak open right after that, I did the only thing I could think of doing. So I leapt into Philip's arms and wrapped myself around him, holding on for dear life. Hal proceeded to sit on the toilet and conduct a full meeting with multiple agenda points with the showering Philip, who was trembling as he tried to keep me hoisted in the air. Brevity was not Hal's gift. He wondered aloud why Philip was taking such a long time to shower, and then the hot water ran out. And still, Hal persisted. By the time he went back out into the main office, we were trembling from cold, fear, and exhaustion, and trying not to collapse in laughter. Somehow, as Philip was leaving, he managed to wrap his towel around him and also take mine, using it to dry his hair and trying to look casual. The impact was that I was trapped, naked in the bathroom, while Philip and Hal continued their conversation just on the other side of the door. One last thing you should know. There was a second door to the bathroom that opened to an exterior back porch. From that porch, one could reach the exterior door to the living quarters, which would have been a good option for escape, except that the families from Calvary Baptist Church had arrived to set up a picnic for their boys in the shelter right behind the cabin. So I cracked the door, waited patiently as the troop arrived, and on until they were saying grace. With eyes closed and heads bowed, I made my break with only a washcloth to cover. So a week later, camp came to a close. That night, Philip and I sat under a full moon at the base of the flagpole. Our conversation was slow and stilted as we leaned into one another. "So what happened next?" I asked. He didn't reply. "Philip, I love you." I said it out loud for the first time. "And I know that you love me. We can do this. We'll figure it out. Fuck the rest of them. This is real." And with all the passion of a 17-year-old in love, I began to weep. "I'm sorry," he said. "I just can't." He got up and walked away. We didn't speak for the next several weeks until after we got home. And he lived just 5 minutes away, but might as well have been across the country as far as I was concerned. I grieved quietly, with no one safe to name what was happening. Then one weekend, my sister came home from college. "I've got a date," she proclaimed proudly, "with Philip." My face must have lost all color, because the next thing she said was, "Don't worry. We know how important his friendship is to you, so he made me promise that you and he would go hang out before our date." And that became our pattern until I couldn't stomach it any longer and made sure I was out when he came by. Eventually, the end of the semester came, and with it, my sister Amy's winter formal. Her sweet but awkward roommate Christine needed a date, and after a bit of pressure, I gave in and agreed to take her. The result was a double date. Me, my sister, my sister's roommate, and the man I loved. Philip and I had not seen each other for 2 months. We worked our way through the night awkwardly. They'd rented a hotel room with another couple, and all six of us piled in. The other couple in one bed, Amy and Philip in the other. Christine slept in the space between the two beds, and I between the bed and the window on the floor right beside Philip. I laid eyes open and wide awake as the chatter stilled and the soft snoring began around me. When all was quiet, I felt his hand reach out from the covers and once again take mine. And we stayed like that the rest of the night, holding hands in the dark. I wouldn't see Philip again for 7 years after that night. My heart was broken and his silence so loud that I came to wonder if I'd made up the whole thing. We were reunited when, after a suicide attempt, our old friend and cabin mate Robert came out as gay. I'd long since left scouting and had a serious boyfriend by then, but we both showed up for Robert when he was released and helped him settle back home. He slept, and Philip and I set to washing the dishes. After some silence, he stared out the window. "You were right," he said. "I did love you." He reached into the soapy water and took my hand. We stood like that for a while, holding hands and staring out the window, remembering all of who we had been, all of how we had changed. Then I turned to him with a smile, and I let go.
Brian, thank you so much. What a wonderful story. And just to be clear to everyone, if you're not familiar with our live events, 10x9 is not a comedy night. There are plenty of laughs, but there are also a lot of serious stories with just about everything else in between as well. So please, if you want to tell a story, you do not have to make us laugh. Just a quick thank you very much to all of you who have donated to 10x9 via Patreon and at our live events over the years. It really helps to keep this project going, and we are really so grateful. For those of you wondering, 10x9 has always been free, but unlike other free things such as social media, looking at you Facebook, there are no catches, so just enjoy. Okay, on to our third and final story on this special Blast from the Past podcast. It was August 2016, and the theme was love. The storyteller was making her debut. Here's Louise Nealon.
There's a reason why farmers don't allow their children to name cows. They mean to shield us from the harsh realities of life until we're old enough to appreciate a perfectly cooked steak. Occasionally, my dad calls the milking cows names if they get their heads stuck in a feeder or if they break through an electric fence. But these are names that can't be repeated in polite company. Names are too personal, but numbers are sufficient enough to record their existence and identify the ones old enough to be sent on a one-way trip to the meat factory. I suppose it was my fault that I accidentally tricked my dad into naming and thus cultivating a relationship with one of our bulls. It was my 10th birthday. I was helping to feed the calves when Dad produced a contraption that looked like a medieval version of the ear-piercing gun from Claire's Accessories and a plastic bag of yellow tags that he handed to me. 4 calves had been born that day and they needed to be tagged. Dad tugged at a calf's ear with one hand and reached out for the ear tag with the other. As I looked down at the tag to hand to him, I had an epiphany. It was a number, but the number is also a name. "Is that calf a boy or a girl?" I asked. "A boy, why?" I handed him the tag. He had given the calf an earring before he clocked the number and smiled to humour me. 007. I picked up the cat that was nuzzling into my leg and put its tail across my face with a moustache. I've been expecting you, Mr. Bond. There you go now, that's a birthday present for you, he said, before moving on to the next calf. It was a tiny moment of his day, a happy coincidence that he would have surely forgotten if I had not taken further action. The next day I went into school and announced during our news the segment of the class where juicy bits of local gossip were divulged to the teacher that I had gotten a calf for my birthday. His name was 007 and I was taking bookings for appointments to see him. All havoc broke loose. This is 2001, Celtic Tiger Ireland, and even innocent country children wanted bigger and better. Who knew that calves would be more in demand than Tamagotchis? Pretty soon I was rolling in Nutella sandwiches, strawberry milk, Dairyly Dunkers and Pokemon cards, all bribes offered in exchange for kids to bump up the waiting list to meet 007. Eventually, the teacher intervened and rang my mother to ask if she could bring the class to the farm to see him. You'd swear David Attenborough himself had asked to come for tea. Mom made Dad put on his best overalls and I briefed him on what to expect, requesting 007 to be moved to one of the nicer pens, the one without the bent bucket holders and less rusty hinges, and preferably front and centre. This is only the beginning of the special treatment 007 was about to receive. I thought that since he was my birthday present, I would know all the answers to the questions the teacher would ask, but I was outdone by Dean Mulligan. He knew that 007 was a Frisian and he would grow horns that would have to be cut off. Is he going to be a bull or a bullock? Dean asked. He'll be called in a couple of weeks along with the next batch, Dad answered. I had no idea what they were talking about until Dean informed me later that bulls stay in the field while bullocks have their bits chopped off and are sent to the factory. I'd wound myself into an awful state by the time I got home. Every time Dad came into the house, I shouted, "Murderer!" hoping to shame him out of his unrepented ways. After days of protest, I got the result I wanted. The rest of the males were culled and 007 was placed in the paddock along with the springers. Dad insisted that it was a one-off and that I would have to learn that the world is not fair and sometimes I would have to like it or lump it. I nodded as I tucked into my roast beef dinner. Delighted that I had swayed the powers of the universe in my favour. 2 years passed. 007 had fallen out of fashion with my classmates by the time I had started my first year of secondary school. Both of us reached puberty at the same time, and while I was faced with the prospect of letting a 12-year-old boy poke his tongue into my mouth and let it rest there for as long as we both could hold our breaths, my bovine counterpart had graduated into the wild open fields of paradise, populated with eligible heifers, with whom he was expected to perform. Dad gave him a couple of months to conquer his territory before calling the scanning man. The scanning man was the equivalent of an ultrasound technician, only instead of putting gel on the mammy's tummy, he stuck a mini camera not onto, but into the cow's stomach from the rear end. It was impressive how far he could get his arm to go in there. The whole thing disappeared in, right up to his armpit, and he rummaged around, true story, and he was... He rummaged around for signs of mini 007s, each time coming up with nothing. Not one had a bun in the oven. It didn't make sense. 007 was supposed to be a stud, the bovine James Bond, flanked by an array of Bond girls, with no evil villain to get in the way. But it seemed that he was nothing without his fast cars and fancy gadgets. Dad called him names that can't be repeated in polite company. What am I supposed to do? Get some candles and a takeaway? A picnic basket? Champagne? Vodka martini, shake not stirred, I replied. There is only one remedy. 007 needed a nemesis to get the ball rolling. A big ginger hulk of a limousine bull was let into the paddock. As we walked him stalked through the grass towards the herd, I christened him Goldfinger. 007's ears pricked up, and his eyes locked onto his new rival. His nostrils flared and he began to bellow. They stomped towards each other until they were nose ring to nose ring, all the while Dad praying that they wouldn't kill each other and Mom convinced they were going to. There's going to be too much testosterone in that field, she had warned him before, and she was waiting for a chance to say, You fucking idiot. Now look what you've done. I didn't want to watch. 007 walked in a circle around Goldfinger and started to slow down his breathing. He appeared to want to be given a piggyback. Goldfinger seemed to want to give him a piggyback. They seemed to be getting along well. Too well. Dad had gotten what he wanted, although the chances of procreation had greatly decreased. What the? It's not funny, he shouted at my mother and I. We had both keeled over with laughter and were now on our knees. He's off to the factory in the morning, that's it. I can't sell the fecker. Who wants a gay bull? I'm not sure if 007 sensed the situation that he was in or merely wanted to extend the love to the female next to him, but pretty soon 007 and Goldfinger had invited two heifers to the party, and then another, and then another. And judging by the relieved smile that had fallen across Dad's face, he would live to die another day.
Louise, what a way to make your mark at 10x9. Thanks so much. And thanks too for being such a wonderful supporter. To those of you who might not know, Louise is a best-selling Irish writer. So if you can, get your hands on a copy of her first novel, Snowflake. And that's it for our 301st podcast. You can keep up with all our upcoming events and themes by having a look at our website. That's 10by9.com. And when you find a theme that fits, send me your story. 10by9 is on the socials, of course. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and or Instagram. We've roughly 3,000 followers now on each platform. Our email address is 10by9belfast@gmail.com. Thanks to everyone who has helped keep 10by9 going over the years, including the lovely team at the Black Box, the best venue in Belfast. Thanks to all our 10by9 audiences, of course, going back to September 2011, when it all began. They really make the evening very special. And of course, thanks to all our storytellers in that time, especially all those who've made it onto the podcast since 2017. I'm Paul Dorn, and I'll be back with another regular podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.